Well, good morning, everyone. It's absolutely, I'm really, really delighted to be here. I said to some people earlier, it was worth it just for that view this morning when I got here at 5 to 7. It was absolutely stunning. And I was listening to Joy and thinking that I have a lot of sympathy with what she says. I have lived in the city since I worked for the Reserve Bank, which is about 30 years ago, but I actually grew up in a town called Armidale in northern New South Wales, and it is clichéd, but, you know, they do say it's you can take the girl out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the girl. And I do feel very much still a country girl, notwithstanding that I have lived in the city for many, many years. So what I want to do today is I'm going to talk about financial stability through the lens of the business sector. And financial stability is the area that I'm involved in. I've spoken about financial stability, pardon me, from a number of perspectives in the past. I've spoken about it from the resilience of the banking sector, developments in the property sector, developments in the household sector. So today I want to talk about the business sector. And when we do our financial stability review, which we do every, my little prop here, we do every 6 months, we always devote some time to the corporate sector and the business sector. So I'm going to try and draw out some of the issues that we've been focusing on in recent months. But first of all, what is financial stability and why is it important? What I've said in the past is that there's no universal definition of financial stability. But basically, it's when the financial sector is doing its job of facilitating a smooth flow of funds in the economy to support economic growth. I think it's probably easier to see the opposite, which is financial instability. You can picture this. The financial sector is experiencing disruptions so severe that it harms the economy, and the global financial crisis was a very good, vivid demonstration of what happens to the economy when there's financial instability. Credit supply dries up, investment and consumption fall, unemployment rises. So there's a very human cost to financial stability that we all feel. So it's really important that we have financial stability. So we at the Reserve Bank, we don't have responsibility for supervising financial institutions, but we do have an important role in monitoring the financial system as a whole and the economy as a whole for any financial imbalances that could lead to instability. And we look at things like developments in financial markets, balance sheets of financial institutions and their resilience to changing economic circumstances, and we look at household and business balance sheets. And part of our role is to draw attention to any potential risks that might be building and have an impact on the stability of the financial system. So why are developments in the business sector relevant for financial stability? Well, one obvious link here is that if businesses aren't meeting their financial obligations, they impact on the real economy, and this could have flow-on effects to bank balance sheets through increasing non-performing loans and defaults. But poor performing businesses in one sector can also have flow-on effects to other businesses and therefore to employment and amplify the whole effect. For example, if you have poorly performing retail businesses, that might impact workers as well as owners of shopping centres. Farm businesses, for example, that are affected by the drought, that will reduce their expenditure on capital and equipment. It'll actually affect a range of businesses in their communities that surround them. So all of this can have flow-on effects, and this could also impact on banks if banks have exposures to some of these areas. Oh, thanks. And you could also have specific shocks to particular business sectors, which they mightn't have a financial stability implication as such, but it might mean that that business is more vulnerable if there is a macroeconomic shock or a rise in interest rates or something like that. So we need to try and understand these issues. There's also issues, I think, with respect to developments in specific regions and business conditions in specific regions and those financial institutions that might have exposures to specific regions. So, for example, the end of the mining investment boom, that had significant implications in Western Australia and parts of Queensland. And that in turn saw large falls in housing prices, increases in arrears in many of these areas. Now, the banks seem to be managing this, and we don't think that the arrears contributes to financial instability at this point, but it does illustrate, I think, that financial stability implications of business conditions, when you think about that, it's important to give considerations to sectors, to regions, and even the size of the firms that we're talking about. So I'm going to, in the rest of the speech now, just talk a little bit about some aspects of business conditions that I think are relevant to thinking about financial stability. I'll talk a little bit about business in aggregate, and then I'll focus on some individual sectors, and I'm going to finish talking about the small business sector. So when we look at the business sector, there's a number of metrics that we use to look at financial health of firms. So one is profitability or return on equity, and that gives a general an idea of the general health of the business. If you're not, if a firm isn't very profitable, it's more likely to cease operations and potentially default on debts, obviously. So gearing or debt is another thing we look at, and that's how much debt to equity there is in the business. So if firms have high gearing or a lot of debt relative to equity, they're vulnerable if asset prices fall, and they're vulnerable if they make losses in their operations because they've got a relatively small equity buffer. And that makes them a little more prone to bankruptcy and default. Debt servicing ratios are another important thing. So this is the ratio of interest expenses on debt to the profits of the business. So this tells you an indication of how they can meet their debts. So the higher this is, the more vulnerable they potentially are. And finally, liquidity measures. So that's basically cash as a ratio to firms' liabilities. And as many of you probably know, liquidity, this is actually important for firms' abilities to meet their current liabilities as they become due. So higher liquidity is better. So these are the four metrics we typically look at. And the most current data we have on the financial positions of businesses from this perspective is from listed corporations. So companies on the stock exchange, they tend to be a little bit larger. They have they have to report regular information, and this is a useful source of information for us on monitoring their financial health. Small businesses are unlisted, and information on them is less readily available and comes with a longer lag. But because they account for most of the borrowing, large businesses pose a greater risk to financial stability. That's not to say that small businesses aren't important, and I'm going to come back to talk about small businesses. So on the basis of the listed companies reporting, in 2018, conditions were positive overall, and they were supported by continued economic growth and low interest rates. So I have a graph here of those four ratios I just talked about. And you can see on the top left, in aggregate, the profits of listed non-financial corporations have looked pretty healthy over recent years. The aggregate return on equity of these firms was around about 25% in 2018. That's a little higher than it was since the GFC. Gearing and debt servicing ratios have trended lower, so they're the bottom two panels, and liquidity has increased further. So all of this means that in aggregate, firms have a larger equity buffer in their businesses, they're less vulnerable to unexpected decreases in cash flows, and they're better placed to repay their short-term financial obligations. So this is all good from the perspective of financial stability. But it's important to realise that the aggregate numbers can disguise substantial differences among firms because there's a big spectrum here. And therefore, it's important to look at the distribution of the various financial metrics. So what I mean by that is you look at the whole range of firms and you identify those perhaps that are more vulnerable, so those that are at the bottom end of the profitability distribution, those that are perhaps at the top end of the debt distribution. So what I'm going to do is show some graphs now that look at this distribution. And what you can say is that if you're looking at profitability and liquidity, if you look at firms that have the lowest, in the lowest group of profitability and liquidity, they're more vulnerable. And the firms that are in the top range of debt and debt servicing, they're more vulnerable. So they're the sorts of, and what I'm going to use is this term called the 25th percentile. Now, you don't really have to know what that means, but it means that they're the 25% of firms that we think are the most vulnerable in any particular ratio. So if I look at this, and some of you may have difficulty seeing the chart, and I apologise, these are the financial positions of those same four metrics of what we call vulnerable firms. So focus on the blue line, which is on the top panels, and the red line on the bottom panels. These are the 25% of firms that we think are the most vulnerable in each of these areas. So you'll see on the top left that the least profitable 25% of companies are actually making losses, although it's maybe stabilised a little bit over the last few years. But these companies tend to have very little debt, so there's not many potential flow-on effects to the financial sector. If you look at the bottom, you'll see the gearing ratios, so the top 25%, those that have the most debt, those gearing ratios have come down, certainly since the GFC and prior to the GFC. So you'll see that as that's come down, the bottom right panel, you'll see debt servicing ratios have also come down. So even though these firms are the ones that are the most vulnerable, their gearing and their debt and their debt servicing has come down over the past decade. And you'll also see, if you look at the top right, that the liquidity position of the most vulnerable has actually been reasonably stable. So in general, it would seem that the financial stability risks from these firms that are the most vulnerable, they're not increasing. So that's a positive thing for financial stability. Another perspective that I want to talk about, and I mentioned in my introduction, is sectoral differences. So I'm going to focus on two here today. I'm going to focus on the retail sector and the mining sector, because I think they provide some interesting contrasts. So domestic retailing, particularly bricks and mortar retailing for discretionary goods, so the things you don't have to buy, that's been experiencing very challenging conditions in recent times. Competition from large and large retailers, international retailers, online retailers, that's all been very intense. Consumer spending has been growing quite slowly, and consumer preferences are changing. So some colleagues of mine undertook some work on what might be the potential financial stability risks associated with the retailing sector, and they did this last year. And broadly what they concluded was that although retailers and investors in property, in retail property, face a number of risks, there's actually no strong evidence of widespread vulnerability at this point, or that the risks to banks are very high. So they found that while listed discretionary good retailers appear to be in good financial health overall, there were some signs of financial difficulties in some of the unlisted and smaller retailers. And I'm going to show a couple of graphs from their work, which again lists the four main metrics that I focused on. Now, I'm warning you, there's going to be a lot of information on this graph, so I'm going to just draw out a couple of points. I don't want you to worry too much about the detail on the graph. So this is listed retailers. And what I want you to focus on, so the yellow line is the median. The median is basically the point at which 50% of firms are lower than that and 50% of firms are higher than that. So if you looked at the profitability, the yellow line, it says that 50% of firms have profits, return on equity of a bit more than 30%, and 50% have a bit less than that. And the two other lines are just the extremes. So a few points I want to make here. The first is that profitability, if you look at the top left, has remained broadly stable at a high level. So companies here appear well positioned to meet their short-term liabilities. And the liquidity ratios are reasonably stable as well. So everyone appears quite stable and able to meet their liabilities. If you look at the bottom graphs, you'll see gearing, so debt, has been broadly unchanged and at fairly low levels. And you'll also see that as interest rates have declined, debt servicing ratios have trended down as well. Unlisted retailers, on the other hand, aren't really so well positioned in terms of gearing and liquidity. And this graph shows a similar thing, But if you look at profits, again, reasonably stable. Liquidity is reasonably stable for most, but there is a very substantial, if you look at that top line, 25% of retailers have lots of liquidity, and then the red line shows you that the retailers that have very little liquidity are only a very small proportion. So that's positive. Around about one quarter of unlisted retailers are highly indebted. So if you look at the bottom left panel there, you'll see the blue line. That's tells you that around about 25% have gearing ratios of 100% and upwards. So that implies that their debt is larger than their equity. So that makes them potentially vulnerable. So this means that there's a potential that some of these might not be able to meet their short-term liabilities without selling assets, because so basically their gearing is very high, so their debt is high, and that means that they might have difficulty meeting their debt servicing if they strike macroeconomic shocks or business conditions turn down. There's another thing that's happened in the sector, and that is that the share of loss-making retailers has increased over recent years. These retailers tend to be smaller on average, and they account for around about 10% of retail sector debt. The other thing my colleagues found is if you looked across both the listed and the unlisted companies, small retailers are more likely to be identified as vulnerable than large retailers. And what they did here was they looked at retailers that had two of these four ratios in vulnerable areas, and using that, they said, well, if a firm has a high gearing ratio, but it's able to sustain this relative to strong, because it's got strong profitability, then that's okay. But if it has a high gearing ratio and a very low liquidity ratio, then they might be struggling. So one ratio by itself does not mean that a firm is going to be vulnerable. So taken together, smaller retailers seem to be facing more difficult conditions in both sectors. But there is, as I said, no sign of widespread vulnerability, and difficulties in the sector seem unlikely to pose a significant risk to the banking sector. But there are challenges faced by the bricks and mortar retailers, and these have spilled over into demand for retail floor space. So conditions are weakest in mid-sized shopping centres, where vacancy rates have increased to about 5%. That's up from around 3% a few years ago. Vacancy rates, so this shows you the vacancy rates, and if you focus on the yellow line, the mid-sized shopping centres, you'll see that the vacancy rates there are rising. Rents have been flat over the last few years, and landlords have been attempting to avoid vacancies by increasing incentives and changing tenancy mixes. Retail valuations have also, they've been rising, but much slower than other commercial property valuations. And at the same time, there's been a considerable increase in retail development opportunities in recent years. So this is both refurbishments and building of new centres. So it's possible that some of this might be keeping pace with population growth, but it's also possible that the new and improved shopping centres will simply cannibalise business from other shopping centres, and you'll end up with excess supply, and that's particularly in the light of weak consumer spending. So if this happens, this would weigh on rents and it would weigh on valuations of property, and to the extent that owners of these shopping centres hold debt, they might find themselves in difficulties servicing, and if they have to sell, that might result in further price declines, and the whole thing might spiral. Ultimately, what happens for financial stability depends on the exposures of financial institutions to these retail businesses and developers. So the third issue that my colleagues addressed was banks' exposures to retail commercial property development. And given the increase in retail property development over the past decade, it's perhaps not surprising to see that banks' exposures have also risen, and you'll see this. So the left panel is the major banks' exposures to retail businesses. and the right panel is their exposure to retail properties. So you'll see it's increased quite sharply in terms of retail properties. Over the past few years, it's sort of come down from their exposure to retail businesses. But at around about $60 billion, the exposure to retail properties itself represents less than 3% of major banks' assets. So even though there's difficult conditions in this sector, this isn't necessarily translating into a deterioration in loan performance. Non-performing loans in the retail sector remain reasonably low. So while there may be vulnerabilities, those don't currently seem to be posing a significant risk to the financial sector. The second sector I briefly want to focus on is mining. And in contrast to the mining sector, in contrast to the retail sector, mining firms have actually experienced improved condition recently. And that's been driven by increasing commodity prices. So these are the same four metrics that I was talking about for the mining sector. You'll see profitability has increased to over the past few years. They've got a lot of liquid assets as well. You can see that in the top right panel. And you'll see that their debt, their gearing ratios, and their debt servicing burdens are also coming down. So, and in fact, their debt levels are actually quite low compared with firms outside the resources sector as well. So as a result, mining firms' balance sheets appear very well placed to absorb shocks, and perhaps more than has been the case for some time. So while the risks to related to market conditions have abated, this has occurred alongside ongoing improvements in mining firms' balance sheet positions. They've reported a strong focus on reducing costs, realising efficiencies, and paying down debt. And while banks' direct exposures to the mining sector tend to be very low, at around about 1%, the mining sector itself accounts for around 20% of Australia's business investment. And so there are very important spillover channels to the rest of the economy. So the improved position of mining firms reduces risks to other parts of the economy. Now, the final issue I want to talk about briefly is conditions for small business and the risks that could arise from this source. So small businesses account for 70% of employment and 40% of production of the private non-financial sector. Difficult conditions in small business could therefore have flow-on effects to the economy through decreasing employment and lower income for unincorporated enterprises, and hence to the health of household balance sheets more broadly. And these effects are often felt particularly in regional areas because small businesses in these areas are part of the lifeblood of the community. And finally, there could be effects on banks' asset quality if non-performing loans rise. Now, small businesses, Joy alluded to this, but small businesses have been facing tighter credit conditions over the past year or so, and that's from a level that was already pretty tight, quite frankly. Over the past couple of years, lending to small businesses, and the way I'm defining this is businesses of annual turnover of less than $50 million, you'll see that it's hardly grown at all, whereas lending to large businesses actually has grown by around about 5% on average. Now, there's a number of reasons why small businesses might be facing these tighter credit conditions. First of all, there's a bit of a blurring of the line between lending to small business and personal credit. So there are obligations placed on financial institutions for lending to consumers. Those are the responsible lending obligations. And these are stricter than requirements for lending to small businesses. And actually, they've even tightened, I suspect, over the past couple of years, particularly in response to the Royal Commission and some of the behaviour that was revealed there. But lenders, we think, are increasingly treating small businesses like household borrowers, and they're imposing the stricter conditions on small business lending. And in addition to that, property is a common form of security for small business lending. Around about 50% of loans to small businesses are secured by residential property. And the decline in housing prices over the past couple of years is therefore likely to have reduced the amount of money that small businesses can borrow. Having said that, some colleagues of mine have done some work on the characteristics of firms that are likely to receive credit, And they showed that the size of the business is clearly very important consideration, but there are some other factors, and these other factors include profitability, debt servicing ratio and credit history. So if you're more profitable, you're more likely to get a loan, but it's still the case that small businesses find it more difficult to get loans. So the tighter credit conditions have made it more difficult for small businesses to fund themselves or to refinance existing debt, and it's likely, to be particularly challenging in regional areas that are impacted by the drought, where many businesses are already experiencing difficulties. It's possible that these tighter credit conditions might push small businesses into failure and default on their loans, but any impact from this channel on the financial system at this stage is still quite small. If you look at non-performing loans in the private unincorporated sector, so this is the blue line, you'll see that they've risen a bit over the past year or so, but they still remain at relatively low levels. And lending to this sector still accounts for a fairly small share of banks' assets. So in conclusion, I'd just like to basically sum up. I've tried to outline a view of stability of the Australian financial system through the lens of the business sector. And what I'd conclude is that in general, the financial health of businesses looks sound. There are some individual sectors and regions that do face challenges, but these currently don't provide a threat to financial stability. Financial institutions themselves are resilient and their exposures to these areas remain low. But it's nevertheless important to keep an eye on developments in this business sector and remain alert to possible risks to financial stability from this source. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. It was really good to hear firsthand how the business sector is relevant to the financial stability in our region. So we've got question time now for Michelle. So I hope the audience has been listening closely and got some questions. But in the meantime, I've been listening and there's a few questions that I've got that I thought was quite relevant, and I wouldn't mind knowing Michelle's thoughts on it. So, Michelle, you talked about tight credit conditions for small businesses, and we all know that we've been facing it, and certainly for the last year it seems to be getting worse. It's a great big concern for our Chamber members. What policies could improve access to our finance?
Yep. Am I on? Yes, I am on.
Yep.
Yes. it is a good question. As I highlighted in my speech, credit for small businesses has been a perennial issue for some time. And we know it's been tight, and we know, as I said, that it's tightened up even further recently. This isn't positive. I think there's a few things on the horizon. The first is that the government has introduced the Australian Business Securitisation Fund. For those of you who don't know what this is, the government have committed about $2 billion, and that money is going to be used to invest in securitised small business loans. The market for securitised mortgage lending is big. There's lots of securitised mortgage lending. Small business lending has been more difficult to get off securitised. Small business lending has been more difficult to get off the ground. So the idea of this securitisation fund is the government will put money into buying securitised loans from smaller banks and non-ADIs, so they're not aiming at the big banks, they're aiming at small banks. And this hopefully will kickstart, help these institutions to make loans, securitise them, which then they can be purchased by this government fund, in effect. So that's one thing. The banks themselves are looking at the possibility of putting together a fund. Now, that one is for the private sector to do. And the idea is there that they would, all the banks would commit money to a fund, and that fund would be used to make loans to small businesses. So that's another positive policy prescription. The other thing, there's two other things that are happening. One of the issues with small businesses is information. So when making loans for mortgages, I think banks find it relatively easy to understand what information they need. With small businesses, it's a little bit more bespoke. So I think what might help is that we've now got comprehensive credit reporting, and we've got open banking coming as well, and that's going to allow
people and businesses, small businesses, to share their information with other financial institutions, and this might help to introduce some competition and help to overcome some information barriers that currently are there. So I think there's a few things on the horizon, but I think from Reserve Bank's perspective, not just from a financial stability perspective, but also from the perspective of the economy, tight conditions for small business lending is not helpful.
You mentioned the thoughts in the government actually having some new policies. Do you have a time frame in regards with those, or is it more of a long-term thought of?
So the Business Securitisation Fund is up and running. It's got a timeline over the next few years to inject. I think there's $250 million for the next year or so, and then another $500 million. So they're basically building it up. So that does have a timeline, and as I said, it's already up and running. Mm. The private sector venture isn't so much up and running. That one's taking a bit more time. Open banking is coming in the next few years. So things are happening. It might be a little slow for small business people, but things are happening. Mm.
You also mentioned the drought. What are your thoughts on the agriculture sector and where they're standing at this particular moment and, I guess, their future predictions?
Sure. So the agricultural sector, because quite a large portion of the agricultural sector is unincorporated and not listed, we don't have a lot of current information. We have a lot of anecdotes. We can observe ourselves a lot of what's going on there. But we don't have a lot of really current hard data. I'd go back to what I said in my speech, which is that the agricultural sector, particularly in regional communities, its influence the impact it can have is actually much bigger than its size. So even though the agricultural sector might account for a relatively small part of the total production, its influence spreads broader, because if farms aren't spending and they're finding it difficult, that flows onto small businesses in the areas as well, and that then has a amplified effect. So I guess what I would say in response to that is that we need rain, but I think we ought to be very alert to the flow-on effects that difficulties in the agricultural sector might be having more broadly on other businesses.
Yeah, definitely. I did notice last night there was a bit of rain. I woke up to rain, so that was always a good sign. Last night I was watching the news, and it did state there's starting to be a slow move in the housing sector. How's the RBA viewing that?
Yeah, so the housing sector is an interesting one. Joy mentioned the Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne-centric view, and often when people are talking about the housing market, they are talking about Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane. What's happened basically is that after rising very, very sharply, housing prices in Melbourne and Sydney in particular have come off quite a lot over the last 2 years. The issue of that for financial stability is that concern that if people get into difficulties with their loans and prices are falling, they can't get out of difficulties by selling their house if their house is now worth less than the debt. So from a financial stability perspective, we've been focusing on this, trying to understand the potential implications for households and banks if prices fall so far that people find it difficult to get themselves out of difficulty. We haven't seen that typically. So even though prices have fallen a lot, most people bought their houses still a long way prior to that, and they're still quite high in Sydney and Melbourne. Having said that, there are some areas of the country that in particular Western Australia, housing prices in Perth have been falling for years and years and years and years and years. And there are a lot of people in Perth for whom debt now is higher than the value of their home. So that is an arrears arising in Perth, in Western Australia. So that does pose some potential risks. Mm. I think what we're observing now is that things seem to have stabilised a bit in Sydney and Melbourne. Ultimately, I think that is good for the whole economy, because I think what's been happening is that as housing prices have been falling, that's been putting a bit of a damper on people's sentiment. That might be partly one reason why people aren't consuming. So when that puts sort of dampers on sentiment, then that's not good for the economy. So hopefully with a bit of a stabilisation in the housing market, the financial stability concerns will come off a bit and hopefully people might feel a little bit more comfortable.
Did anyone else in the audience have any questions?
Thanks. Thanks, Michelle. Very interested to, I mean, Australia is a very externally focused economy, and currently we've got two elephants going at it pretty hard, to our north and east. So how concerned is the RBA about the impact on our terms of trade with the trade war between the United States and China?
Yeah, look, it's a good question, and it's a question that a lot of people are very interested in at the moment. We've spoken a little bit about this, and I suspect you'll hear a bit more about this from the Governor tomorrow when he fronts before the parliamentary hearing. What I would say is that our concern here is that the extent to which this trade war is meaning that a lot of businesses are saying, I don't want to invest because I'm just not sure what's going to happen. So with businesses all holding back on their investment, that's obviously having impacts more broadly on the economy and world economy, this economy as well. So I think the biggest concern is that unless the uncertainty gets resolved, hopefully in a positive way, not a negative way, then businesses will come back and start investing because they're just not confident at the moment. If I have my financial stability hat on, from our perspective, what we're more interested in, I guess, is the potential flow-on effects. If this has big impacts on China and China's economy starts to slow dramatically, that, as you've mentioned, we're very exposed to China, that might have implications for us, for our economy. And if it has implications for our economy, things turn down, unemployment goes up, that's when we might start to see arrears rise, those sorts of things, and that's when the financial stability sort of concerns start to come to the fore. So, number one, investment is the thing that's suffering at the moment, and number two, we'll be watching closely what goes on with China's economy.
Michelle, as of yesterday, the Aussie dollar against the US has hit a 10-year low, which is a pretty bad situation. And from my understanding, as far as the balance of trade numbers is concerned, a lot of it's reliant on the iron ore sector, and that's pretty much dependent on a mine collapse in Brazil, which now the Brazilians seem to have sorted out, and they're starting to export again. So moving forwards, what is the Reserve Bank view as far as the balance of trade is concerned? The Aussie dollar, interest rates, I think, the cash rate, I think, is now at 1%.
Yep.
Which means you can't go when you go down to like 0.25, that's quantitative easing territory. Is that all on the cards?
Well, yes, a number of questions in there, some of which I probably don't have the jurisdiction and remit to answer. First point I would make is the Governor is talking tomorrow morning, 9:30, to the parliamentary hearing. He's going to be asked every single one of those questions, I suspect, and listen to his answer. A couple of general points, though. The exchange rate, as you know, Australia has a floating exchange rate. And the exchange rate is part of the mechanism through which monetary policy works in Australia. So when interest rates decline, usually you see the exchange rate, it's usually in a period when the economy's not doing so well, the exchange rate declines, and that makes our exports more competitive, and that helps us. So that's sort of part of the process of monetary policy working through the system. At the moment, interest rates are at a historic low. The board has already said that they will be monitoring things, and if they need to ease further at an appropriate time, they'll consider that. But at the moment, I think we're just looking at what's happening. We'll wait and see. As I said, though, the exchange rate is a part of the process through which monetary policy works.
Yeah, thank you, Michelle. My question relates probably to some extent to the two former questions, but you've said very little about the cash rate during your presentation this morning. I just wonder if you might be kind enough to give a little bit of background as to the way the RBA looks at and considers the relationship between exchange rate, cash rate, and the bank bill swap rate. Obviously, you know, there's some confidentiality, I imagine, in the way, but just some background as to how the RBA judges those three components of our system.
Sure. So the reason I haven't said anything about the cash rate is that it's actually not my area. I'm not in the monetary policy area. I can give you a few facts, if you like. So the way you would think about it is the cash rate is basically the bank's policy operational rate. So that's the rate that we target as our policy rate. And that interest rate is the interest rate that is paid between banks in the cash market when they're trying to get basically money from one another. So that's basically the cash rate. The bank bill swap rate is something else we also look at. That isn't a policy rate, but that gives you some indications of demand for three-month money, so it's sort of a little bit further. Cash rate's overnight money. The bank bill swap rate's talking about three-month, often three-month. There's a variety of terms, but it's a little further out. And the exchange rate is not something we target as such. So the exchange rate is the end effect of our policies. So as I said earlier in answer to the question over here, part of the way that monetary policy works is you lower the interest rate. That increases the interest rate differential between ourselves and other countries who maybe have left their interest rates where they are. That puts down the pressure on the exchange rate because people can earn returns which are higher somewhere else. And that's part of the monetary policy process. So we don't target the exchange rate as such. So the way I'd say the relationship is we have one instrument, that's the cash rate, and we target that. And then the others are market rates, which tee off that. And there's a general sense in which we want to understand market conditions. So we observe all of those things, but we don't target them. I hope that sort of helps a little bit your understanding. But I'm happy to direct you to some material on our website which actually explains some of this stuff in more detail.
Thank you. Michelle, thanks for coming, and that was a great presentation. Lots of graphs. I wonder what you all get up to in morning tea and lunch hours at your office. How important and critical is sentiment beyond everything else? A lot of data, a lot of numbers, but how critical is sentiment?
Well, I think sentiment is very important, and I alluded earlier to the fact that one of the impacts of the trade dispute seems to be sentiment to invest. So it has a very real impact. Consumer sentiment, obviously, if consumers aren't confident, then they're not going to spend. So I think that is really important. And we do look at a number of sort of indicators of sentiment. They're not hard data in the sense they're not actual numbers of houses being built or actual numbers of actual tons of iron ore being dug out of the ground, but they're things that you can look at to get an idea for how people are feeling about things. So yes, I think the answer is yes, it is important.
Thank you, Michelle. That's probably all the time that we do have for this morning. Feel free if you'd like to speak to Michelle perhaps afterwards if you'd like to discuss some more issues or discuss some more matters with her. Would you please put your hands together and thank Michelle.